Hello, folks, and welcome to Reflections in Natural History. George Sly here. Some of you may have taken a look at my blog site, which is reflectionsinnaturalhistory.com, and noticed that over the last few weeks I've been talking about parasitic organisms. As a biologist, of course, this is an area that I find quite interesting, and in my blogs I've talked about particularly the strange world of parasites that control the mind of their hosts through biochemical or other means. But I wanted to finish up with my ruminations upon the world of parasites with sort of a last look at some that I just find simply creepy, including a couple of them that are parasitic upon humans, of course. My mind rushes back now over 40 years to my undergraduate parasitology course. This class was taught by a fellow by the name of William Hopp. And Dr. Hopp was a professor of the old school, I suppose you could say. He was well-versed in the whole gamut of subjects that fall under the umbrella of natural history. And it seems that this discipline has kind of fallen out of favor lately, as the biological sciences have rapidly progressed into the more specialized realms, cell biology, molecular biology, genomics, forensics, physiological ecology, you could go on and on, I suppose. But once upon a time, it was considered a mark of pride and of a well-rounded science education to have knowledge which ranged over a spectrum of fields, from geology to botany to mammalogy and back to ichthyology, roamed the well-versed scientist, the natural historian. Such a person was Dr. Hopp. He even popularized his interests with a weekly show that aired on Saturday mornings on one of the local TV stations. Snakes and other reptiles were often favorite guests on his show, but he could converse on a broad range of biological subjects. Dr. Hopp was a great storyteller as well, and one of his tales set me upon a pathway of keen interest regarding the world of parasites. And this story revolved around the fact that humans are considered fair game by a variety of parasitic organisms. So the story was something like this. There was a young man who had become infected by the roundworm Ascaris, and this is an unsegmented, somewhat primitive roundworm, but it's about 6 to 8 inches in length. And Ascaris is a parasite of the human small intestine. Although in its larval form, it's prone to wander through several body organs as part of its life cycle. People become infected with Ascaris when they accidentally ingest the worm's eggs. These eggs are present in the intestinal waste of infected individuals, of course. When I lived in Southeast Asia, there were certain groups of people there that used human waste as a garden fertilizer. And as you can imagine, this is an excellent way to ensure that Ascaris eggs get onto the vegetables that people are subsequently going to eat. At any rate, Dr. Hopp related how this particular infected person was given an oral dose of what we call a vermicide, which is basically just a medication that's meant to pass into the digestive tract where it kills the worms. And these dead worms then are voided with the feces. On this occasion, however, the worm medicine acted only to aggravate the parasite and caused it to attempt to migrate away from the source of its irritation. So up through the alimentary canal it came until, having reached the throat of the poor guy, it proceeded into the back of his nasal cavity and then sought escape via the fellow's nostril. Well, the image formed in my mind of that of my classmates of an 8-inch worm emerging from a person's nostril was disgustingly gruesome. As neophyte parasitologists, the idea that something so ghastly could actually happen to a human caused the class to groan in dismayed unison. Of course, we were kids that were basically just out of our teens and still had that sort of morbid fascination with the gross. So this story was a big hit. But nevertheless, I was kind of synergized, I guess, by a morbid fascination with such disgusting stories and creatures. And from then on, parasitology was kind of a lifelong fascination for me. Naturally, humans aren't the only animals subject to some pretty nightmarish parasitic infections. And I think one of the most bizarre involves a parasitic marine isopod. You are probably familiar with isopods as the little segmented grayish invertebrates you encounter under an old board or paving stone in the yard. Upon being disturbed, they typically curl up into a tight little ball and wait for you to go away. And people often call these pill bugs, or roly-polies is another common name for them. However, there is a giant member of their clan that lives in ocean waters and is parasitic on several different species of fishes. This isopod, which grows to about an inch in length, which is pretty big for an isopod, is called Cymothoa. And as a juvenile, it floats freely in the water, and in this way, it's able to enter a host fish as the water is passed over the gills. So the mating occurs in the fish's gill chamber, and then a female moves into the fish's mouth cavity, and there it latches onto the poor creature's tongue. Cymothoa then proceeds to feed on the blood of the fish's tongue. This causes that organ to atrophy until only a stump remains. The isopod remains attached to the muscles of this stub and begins to actually function as the fish's tongue. The tongue-eating isopod. How macabre is that? I'm sure glad it doesn't have a taste for humans. It would put a whole new spin on accidentally getting a mouthful of seawater while swimming, wouldn't it? Of course, there are many parasites that do infect humans with distressingly dreadful consequences. One of my friends once jokingly asked me why I had a propensity for visiting countries that change their government every 6 months. But in all honesty, the fear that often creeps into my mind before such trips is not based upon unstable governments, but rather knowledge of tropical parasites. In these regions of the world, some of the parasites of humans are simply awful. Take lymphatic filariasis, for example. This is a disease caused by a tiny roundworm parasite known as a filarial worm, and it is transmitted from one human to the next by mosquitoes, and such an infection over time can have dramatic and pretty horrible consequences. The problem is that these little worms, when they occur in massive numbers, can block the flow of lymphatic tissue within the body. Thus dammed, the backed up fluid causes the surrounding tissue to undergo tremendous edematous swelling, which results in the disease we call elephantiasis. The result of this swelling can be legs larger than the diameter of the torso, pendulous breasts the size of watermelons, or a scrotum the size of a beach ball. The disfigurements are, of course, psychologically devastating, and the enlargement of body regions can be so extreme that they will actually inhibit the person's ability to move around. A deformity of this sort, though, really, honestly, requires repeated infections with the microfilarial worm, which is known as Wuchereria, that's its genus name. And these infections have to occur over a period of years. You don't just get a bite from a mosquito and one or two of these worms, and all of a sudden you have this awful disease. Fortunately, although about 15% of the human population lives in areas where elephantiasis is endemic, these really extreme cases are quite rare. Just as an anecdote, during the 3 years that I lived in Southeast Asia, I actually saw only one case of this disease, and the person afflicted exhibited only a slight swelling of one leg. And then there is another one that kind of tends to creep me out, and this is the scientifically named Dermatobia hominis, in common lingua, the human botfly. I first encountered this parasite on a trip to Costa Rica several years ago, and as I said, I have to admit, it gives me the creeps. Dermatobia is actually a rather robust fly that measures about 3/4 of an inch in total length. To me, it somewhat resembles a blowfly we might see buzzing around a roadkill opossum here in Indiana. If that was the habit of Dermatobia as well, we might rest easily in its presence. But as you can guess, this botfly isn't nearly as innocuous. Like other flies, this species goes through an elaborate reproductive metamorphosis in which it proceeds stepwise from egg to larva to pupa to adult. The larva, again, as in other members of the fly order, is a maggot. But the human botfly maggot is of rather impressive countenance. The larvae is nearly an inch in length, stout in girth, armed with ringlets of stiff spiny bristles, and has a rather robust pair of jaws. When I first saw the larvae of this fly, they were residing in the soft tissues of the necks of a group of howler monkeys. Each monkey in the troop had from, I'd say 2 to 6 large ping pong ball size lumps on the sides of their necks. One could not help but empathize with the poor primates, helpless as they were to rid themselves of their grisly cargo. I could also not avoid the realization that this fly would just as opportunely infect me in the same manner. One might wonder how a fly as large as this furtively deposit its eggs on either a howler monkey or a human. And surely you would think it would be easy to hear its buzzing approach and shoo it away. But here again, the amazing, might I call it, deviousness in regards to completing a life cycle which has involved in parasites comes into play. The human botfly uses a less detectable emissary to deliver its egg payload, and this carrier, like with so many diseases, the carrier is a mosquito. So using its legs to capture a mosquito, the Dermatobia glues one of its eggs onto the smaller fly's abdomen. When the mosquito lands on its victim, whether monkey or human, the botfly egg is stimulated to hatch by the sudden increase in the ambient temperature. And so, departing the mosquito, the botfly larva enters the skin of its new host. This is usually done either via the puncture made by the mosquito or by way of a hair follicle. So, safely ensconced in its new home in the host's skin and anchored by the aforementioned bristles, the larva now begins to feed and grow. The result is a large lump under the skin, such as I had observed in the howler monkeys. There's an opening in the skin pustule housing the bot larvae, and projecting into this aperture is a pair of spiracles used for breathing. A person thus infected will occasionally feel a sharp stabbing pain as the larva shifts its position as it feeds to the human victim, who has brought this little souvenir of the neotropics home with them. The reaction tends to be both panic and revulsion. If one can mentally cope with the reality of having such a shocking parasite embedded in one's skin, getting rid of it is somewhat anticlimactic, I suppose. Key is depriving the larva of oxygen. And in this way, a colleague of mine who developed a Dermatobia myiasis in his forearm slapped a piece of beefsteak over the wound for a couple of days. With the spiracles blocked and another piece of flesh to move into, the larva obligingly left his arm and crawled into the slab of beef. Others have tried putting nail polish or petroleum jelly over the opening, serving the larva's spiracles, and this has resulted in the maggot creeping up out of their skin. If it should happen that you bring a Dermatobia home with you to the U.S., a trip to the ER would probably be the best option. Here, with the injection of some lidocaine and an incision, the larva can easily be removed. This is assuming, of course, that the physician is somewhat familiar with tropical diseases and recognizes what is going on. This is not always a given. I suppose if one is exceedingly patient and curious, there's another course of action. One could let the larva run its pupal course of development, which takes several weeks. Under natural conditions, the larva eventually crawls out of the skin, falls to the ground, a pupa develops, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, the adult fly emerges from the soil. But alternatively, one could, as an exceedingly inquisitive and, I might say, eccentric biologist once did, carry on your person a small collecting jar. Sensing the movement of the fly larva as it prepares to migrate from the subcutaneous tissue, one could ready the jar. By placing this jar in proper position, one could then collect the emerging larva. With your prize preserved in some isopropyl alcohol, you would be guaranteed to possess a cocktail party conversation starter of rare incident. In spite of my flippancy here, most human parasites are, of course, no laughing matter. The list of organisms which utilize humans as a food source, externally or internally, is a lengthy one. Here in rural Indiana, everyone's familiar with the routine of checking for ticks after a mushroom hunt or a berry-picking excursion. We warn our kids not to lie about in the late summer grass lest they suffer consequences in the form of the maddening itch of chiggers. In the United States, the efficient disposal of human waste along with meat inspection make a case of beef or pork tapeworm, Ascaris infection, or hookworm relatively rare. In other parts of the world, this is simply not the case. When I lived in Southeast Asia back in the 1970s, about 75% of the students in the small college where I taught had worm infections. Another time, talking over dinner with a rural clinic doctor in Peru, I asked what percent of the local population had worm infections. Her answer came very quickly: everyone has them. Given these harrowing glimpses into the frightening world of parasites, you may wonder why I would include them in a series of stories extolling the gifts provided us by the universe. I do so in spite of the fact that they have great potential for causing us misery. Parasitic organisms may indeed generate fear and loathing among our kind, but They should also engender in us a sense of wonderment at the prodigiously sophisticated interrelationships which exist among Earth's biodiversity. The array of behavioral and biochemical and organic adaptations such organisms have evolved are truly astounding in their complexity. Perhaps more than any other group of organisms, the parasites give us cause to reflect upon just how much organic variety, natural selection, operating over eons of time, can create. One final thought. As I've said, here in the United States, we are often isolated from many of the parasitic ills afflicting the poorer nations of the world. Our systems of sanitary waste disposal, meat inspection, and medical care provide us the luxury of giving little thought to the nightmarish possibilities of infection by these organisms. However, more and more of us travel the world these days. We may take with us the attitude that parasites are rare creatures that attack other people. We would be better advised to remember that there are still monsters out there. Be wary of the ice cubes in your drink. Give serious thought before eating that crisp, freshly washed lettuce salad. Think twice about nonchalantly allowing a mosquito to alight upon your arm. My advice? Be careful. Be very, very careful out there. Thanks for listening, and I hope you come back and visit Reflections in Natural History again in the future. Much appreciated.